This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The book is an object. That's how we see it, in a way. You open it up. The moment you open it up, it's magic. All the pages radiate out. It's like the sun rising, setting, doesn't matter. End of day, close of day, you have thoughts generated by the book. So there might be a little core of facts in it, but essentially it moves outwards and should take you somewhere else. So it's not a textbook. I don't do textbooks. You will learn nothing from the book in that sense. But the book is a provocation, and it's more a guide. And the idea behind all my books, Informal, this, Element Number 9, is that if you read it, I want you to feel, hey, I can do better than this. I can do this. I hadn't thought about that before, but I could try that. That's what I want from the books. It's really a kind of educative toy, and as Hans Ulrich Obrister wrote, the introduction said, it's Bauman's laboratory, which it is, really. So, you know, that's what the book is for me. It's a speculation. And what, you know, I have fun with it. There's no point doing it because it's a labor of love. Believe me, I design every page myself and it's so slow. So, you know, it's your professional life takes many journeys, your personal life takes many journeys. And in there are books, many of them. A local zone, a local node, it traps things. It can be a big area trapped or little areas. It depends. And it's not just one book. It's a field condition of books that I planned 15 years ago. I took a long-term view and said I'll have a variety of books and started with number 9, let's say a book on data. That links to my next book coming out next year, which is hyper-algorithmic, all stops, unblocked. It just goes for it. And that will be a very provocative book on automorphic, autogenesis, whatever you want to call it. It explodes the myth of all of that. And that actually was triggered, funny enough, by me doing this book long ago, about 12 years ago. Then I had a workbook in mind, which called Informal, which links literally the last page of Informal, looked ahead to a book one day that would discuss the crossover and overlap between idea and event. I was always fascinated. How do you translate ideas into some event in architecture? Theories are wonderful, but then what do you do? And at the faculty meeting today, we were discussing just that. I wrote a book on nature, proposing a different definition than the Aristotelian of four parts of nature. I had eight. And that links into the big book that, in a way, summarizes the philosophy of all of this. So it's a network of books. It's a speculation, ultimately, on life and what you think about your work. So there's the book. Crossover can mean many things. For me, it was a verb of actually overlapping strands that then straighten themselves out through a black box into the projects. When you're speculating, designing, it's pretty messy in your head, in a way, but they turn out into tracks of events. So for those of you who want to know what the book is really, the other thing I just want to show you is that the actual book took 5 years. And the projects, of course, span. So when Informal was written in 2002, it looked back 10 years. I don't mind that. Someone asked me yesterday, a reporter in London, before I took the plane, why do you write this book now when all the projects have been done? Actually, it's not a bad thing as well, having a relook at projects because they get published, but people then don't understand the inner workings and the dead ends, and I try and open that up in the discussion. So here's the book. It's got 6 big chapters, which in quantity are big. The sculpture, the Serpentine Pavilion, the bridge, and intermediate, medium chapters, art project, the Weave Bridge at Penn, an artwork in Scotland, and Hedge that started life here. CCTV, Battersea Master Plan, a fascinating project I'm doing with Ito, and the pavilions, etc. So they are underpinning, and underpinning all of that are theoretical discussions that it's like a cement on the whole project. So here's the book for those of you who can read fast. 720 pages in 1 minute. Just gives you a feel for the scope. CCTV is in the center of the book, 120 pages, biggest chapter of all, paying credit to this biggest thing of all. And artwork, theory, and we're just about done. There you go. So very quickly then, just a little flavor about what's in these chapters. This is a major sculpture I did with Anish Kapoor. These are all, if you like, co-authorships, where we both invent, push each other, positive tensions. Lovely thing here at the moment of opening, Zaha Hadid came and asked me if this was made of steel. And I said, hit it. And she hit it, and of course it bounced. Because this is 1/16 inch of fabric, spanning 400 foot in the Tate, and about 70 feet high. So it's a huge thing, amazingly made by experts around the world. And the question here was really in this chapter, what is form, what is shape? And in the end, it was a debate Kapoor and I had endlessly about what is, we're looking for what is the thing that actually expresses the intangible called form. And so, you know, was it a massive conduit in the Tate? Or was it some kind of armature? Does it push aside the Tate modern, or is it a conduit taking you through it? And so, and you can see it's monstrous, it's huge, and yet it's quite lyrical in its movements. And just to interest, it's actually one skin, came in a big box the size of this room, that's 400 foot long, and then it gets, the only things that shape it are three rings, one there, one here, and one at this end. And that's all. So unlike any fabric structure, which has pulls and tensions and wires, you don't see anything. It looks, now you don't see it, it just floats. And that is what I try to do in the end. Is this structure? No. Is it architecture? No. Is it sculpture? No. The critics did not know what to say about it. The only good thing I had out of this, I know it was work, Norman Foster rang me the next day and said, amazing, he'd never seen anything like it. And he doesn't give he doesn't give plaudits a lot. And so there we are, and that's the thing. Of course, this took a year and a half to do, and I project managed it as well. In the end, we found no one could handle how to build this thing. And that's another part of invention, is how do you build it and how do you procure it? Without that, you can't do your dream pieces of work. The other one, very famous project now, used by pop stars as well in the backdrop for their songs and videos, is the Serpentine Pavilion. These are a whole range of pavilions I've done. I did the first five with collaborations, and then I overviewed the other five, and then I stepped back because I was worn out doing them. They take only about 4 months from scratch. And so this was with Toyo Ito, my good friend. And what I love about this project is that there is the neoclassical legacy of architecture in a way. And here is a contemporary flux, completely different and yet has its own rigor. It's not whimsical, it stands up. And that comes from the algorithm I invented here, which is a very simple one, childishly simple, from here to here, and then it repeats itself. And then you cut the corners, fold it up, and you actually get a building out of it. I kept a logbook at the time, and I actually published the logbook rather than write about the pavilion. So it's got grammar mistakes, it's got crossings, it's whatever I did at the time, how I thought about it. And I think that's more true than sort of looking back in a way and post-rationalizing. So the logbook is really very entertaining. It's about 15 pages of thoughts, and a whole process of visualization and containment and confinement versus release, which this algorithm does. It's also an important project, I think, in architectural terms, because I think it's the first one that an algorithm completely described the project. And these are early ones I discuss in the book, other models and why they were rejected and why we went back to the simple algorithm. This was one of my favorites that I came up with, made out of polystyrene, huge blocks, zipped together. and stitched in here. These are 1 meter deep, 1.5 meter deep. They're stitched in the middle, they're tongue and grooved kind of connection, and then you zip it up so you can, these are demountable, so you can, the only problem here was they asked me to guarantee it because these pavilions are sold as art objects. And would it last for 10 years, 20 years? I couldn't say. With sunlight on UV, on polystyrene, I didn't know. And Arup would not take any risk on that one, so I had to get out of this one. But pity, because this was Arte Povera with really crude, as in England we say, Heath Robinson, put together in the crudest way. Literally sawed on site, huge blocks of polystyrene put up, and it works. So also the thinking is in the book of how I progress from orthogonalities to curvilinear forms, and the nature of nonlinear work. This is the actual pavilion, but the slightest shift in this angle leads to complete different typologies. The good thing here as well was Isozaki, when he saw this work, he visited the pavilion with me. He said, here is art, architecture, architecture and structure and ornament all in one. Again, it's the seamlessness that defies categorization. All I can take is the delight of people going there or not, and you know it works or it doesn't work. They don't need to know how it happened, but there is something about the symbiosis between overlapping segments that creates some kind of new fusion in forms. And then the pavilion, this is not in the book, I just thought I'd quickly show it to you. It's in Saint-Tropez, and I'm now kitting it out as a restaurant, so I've got the reality of a fire escape. The French authorities don't give a damn for the diagonal, and I've got to go to huge lengths to prove it works. Then they didn't believe it would stand up, and I said it had stood up in England for 3 years after pavilion. Anyway, then we had to put sandbags on the roof to test it. Then they said it would deflect and water would collect and would still collapse. It was impossible dealing with the French. Sorry if any French are here today, but it was really hard. So there it is being kitted out now. We'll open this year. Neighbor to this property is Johnny Depp. And so there's going to be a big time opening end of this year with Johnny Depp coming. And this was the previous life when it was bought from the Serpentine. It went to Battersea, to my master plan that's described in the book. This is a rich Chinese gentleman who bought past the pavilion, had a coffee in it on the Serpentine, thought it would make his wife a good birthday present, and he bought it. So that's her birthday present. And then it was demounted and then shipped, trucked, unbelievably, at 5 miles an hour all the way to Saint-Tropez. I've got pictures of that movement. And this is various way he lit it at Battersea as a meeting room for promoting the master plan. So you can see it's a kinetic object as well. Then the bridge, which was the craziest thing in a way I did, two lines that wouldn't meet was the sketch. This is the original. And thank God I had the guts to stick with it, because the moment you draw something like that as your conception, you panic and think, well, it can't work. That's crazy. And of course, the one thing most students weaken their projects by is not sticking to their first conviction and just going for it. So in the end, I decided, crazy as this sketch was, I'd just go for it. And then it worked in a way that it created a zigzag. But it's not a question of a bridge going and setting aside. I had to invent a new typology for the bridge, which is an edge condition that moves, sets out, disappears, comes out the other side. So it's a rotational supporting system on the edge of everything. So there's imbalance completely through the whole thing. It's on the edge of collapse, but the whole thing creates stability. And that then leads to huge sculptural forms and actually a bridge in the first computer render that didn't meet. So I love that idea. This is the actual bridge that offsets, but actually didn't meet. And of course, I didn't trust the computer render, but I thought it'd be something like it. And this is the actual picture from the other bank. Depending on the sun angle, that can even get blacker and actually doesn't meet. But generally, the sun is playing a game with the fascia condition is fully lit when the sun's on this side, and that retreats into shadow. and then he works the other way as the sun goes on the other side. So it's a bridge that actually moves with light and tricks you into thinking it's much slenderer and thinner than it is. Then everything then went with that. The deck is diagonalized and rotates around this point, so it angles itself from here, zero line, to that way, and then from flips over and tilts. So the entire bridge is a reversal of one half to the other. And I reviewed deck studies, and you know, I discussed these because some were rejected, some were accepted, and why. And there's another shot of the bridge where this is 600 foot across, and it looks like a piece of paper because that really kind of retreats in shadow at this angle. And then kind of Picasso effects. I went for a highly extravagant kind of romantic nature for the balustrades. They only cost $40,000 more to get this fusion glass. And since the bridge was already doing its whatever across the water, I thought, again, I'll go for it. I'd never put colored glass in anything, you know. The modernist imperative to be neat and clean, and I thought, no, I'll romanticize the bridge. So that's what happened, and we got these great Picasso moments. And as the sun goes down, the power of the form comes a bit, this thing that sets astride. The glass starts lighting up and catches fire. Everyone's on this bridge at night, and it becomes a celebration. No more passageway. And kids, of course, building various bridges, we got them to while it was being constructed and gave them a prize. And of course, CCTV, the biggest chapter in the book, which I did with Rem Koolhaas, my long-term collaborator for years when I was doing in Arab. 25 years we've worked together on all the projects from the very beginning, setting very new trends, and Rem and I have been a very good opposition to each other as well, so we promote each other, provoke each other, and answers come out. And this was one of the world's biggest buildings. It must be, I mean, it's 500,000 square foot in one building. And I decided the form was monstrous in a way, and it needed something to do it, and its very configuration of moving up and along as we did that needed a skin. So this chapter is a lot of discussion about rhythm and skin, and the structure, for what it's worth, is an entire skin. They cannot have a backbone, it cannot have any conventional idea of standing up. It stands up because of itself. And the only way to do that is like your human skin, as you change contour, change force and stress, the patterns change. And by a very simple device of halving and doubling, a really primitive device, I got these sensational kind of rhythms that are, you couldn't second guess any of this. And that was done on a kind of octave basis, jumps half and doubles up. And the materiality, there's a discussion on how pattern changes with material. So then here's the generic of the diamonds. And then when you halve and double, you get this. And then when you fold it, you get the CCTV. You get the moving pattern. That's the thing we did for the competition to win it. And then SOM tried to take it away from us in Maryland. They came second. And here it is. I mean, not only is it a great building, but also undeclared, really. It's one of the great feats of engineering. Nothing to do with me. This credit goes to Arup, the huge company that I was leading at one time. And this is how it dances in an earthquake. And to my horror, as being responsible for this project, the 1-in-400-year dictate that they gave us turned to 1-in-2,000-year. And that was like crazy. But doing it, then 9/11 happened as well. It was just after. So I had to test this for flying a jumbo into it as well. And it absorbs anything it can do. If it can take a 1-in-2,000-year earthquake. So that's how it dances around, shakes itself, further shaking, dancing. That's what actually happens. And people in the building are life safe, but the building's whacked at 1-in-2,000-year. And 1-in-200-year earthquakes, you can work there, you won't feel much going on. 1-in-500-year, you start things shaking and falling apart, but you'll be still safe and you can work. Because China's central TV broadcasting, so, you know, it's like Fort Knox, it has to work. And then the reality on site, you know, my God, what had I done, sort of thing, you know. What is this monster? I mean, I've never seen steel like this. And that's where you suddenly, even experienced as I was in building work, you think, oh my God, have I got the scale wrong? Because paper, you know, little things you draw, this whole building's conceived in little sketches like this, Rem and I faxing to each other, and then you come and see this. Oh, Jesus, you know. Look at this one. Look at this guy against this steel. I mean, world's biggest composite columns, technically, if anyone's technical in this room, the world's biggest technical composite columns ever done. Unbelievable, and I honestly swear, I think it's only the Chinese who could have done this. It could not have been done in Britain. Impossible. The way they attacked this, they were proud to do this as well. China wanted to show the world that they could do one of the great buildings. But I was impressed by everything on this site. I couldn't fault it. They really did their best. Very few problems, but look at the scale of this thing. And of course, health and safety hasn't got to China. Look at this guy. And as Rem says, you know, it's art plus building. That's how he sees this as he walks around. This is his pictures. He sends me stuff. He says, look at this. So it's monster in one way, but it's so big it invades your presence as you walk around. The entry lobbies. And there it is. You know, it's a kind of symphony of building. It's huge. You don't realize it's 200 foot each side of this leg. And it's 240 meters high, so that's 700 feet high. You absolutely have no idea, because the pattern, an organizing, shifting movement, it's kinetic, takes your eye in 1 second around it. I keep going and looking at it, and you forget how big it is till you're up there or you're in another skyscraper looking at it. And of course, there was huge speculation. What's going on? As the towers started to meet, all of Beijing were parking around the area waiting to see when the towers would meet. And of course, they thought it was a pretty dangerous affair. Some even in Chinese call it underpants, but I don't know how that came about. So, and of course, the best comment of all was this one. What is it? Is it a new Chinese letter in 3D? A Chinese ideogram? Is it the world's biggest building in one volume? What is it? And then lastly, the other major chapter is again with Ito, who is, I truly think, one of the great architects really working today. Still inventing. He's 72. This was a grid. He's been very interested in my book, Informal, and we've worked on these ideas for a long time. This is a grid, three-dimensional chessboard, but the center lines are allowed to drift. As they drift, this is the base algorithm. Then, of course, I use a smoothing algorithm, and in the end, it's a kind of nesting of cellularization through which program is attacked or inserted or invaded. But I discuss in the book, what is it when you do warp surface? Does the norm and the juxtaposition of the norm with the warp surface help read the project better? Or are you compromising the warp? And should it be all warp, like the early blob architecture of 15 years ago? And of course, there are provocations in it. Ito took the view that he'll cut, and the Cartesian box contains the smooth flow. And I actually think that's a good move here. The prismatic against the curving warp. And here are, again, sort of close-ins, the first 3D prototype I did, and then gradually went through subsequent drifting and smoothing. It's a colony of some kind of colony. And I describe in the book what this kind of architecture is. And of course, technically, amazingly complex surface, beautiful drawings, prototype going up in Taichung. Again, amazing rib work on all the shuttering. Absolutely amazing project. And I think when this is built, which will be halfway through next year, very soon, after about 5 to 10 years of people visiting and going, it'll start rivaling the Sydney Opera House as a kind of a new form, as Sydney Opera House shocked everyone when it came in 56. And there it is, one of the, what I call catenoids going up. The scale is spectacular. Orbit's covered, I won't go into it, it had a lot of press everywhere. The weave bridge is a similar weave, though, to Orbit. These strands, if you look closely, are wound. It's not just this going up and moving in one strand. These also wind themselves up. And in a way, it's the same technique I used before that on the weave bridge at Penn, at the Bauer Field. And it's a coiling in space. It's not a... It has no beams, it has no floors and nothing. It's just one coil. It's like a spring. And it's got its own narrative and artistic progression. And then some two big art installations in the book, the Danza, which is a tetrahedral thing, which has fascinated me for some time, and not in the book, is actually since then I find I can make tall towers very strong using this technique. And this is for Mexico City. This is a 40-story building. And it can look stunning and totally earthquake-proof. Amazingly strong, these buildings. And I think I can go up to about 400 meters with this technique. But back to the Danza in the book, this has many lives. It was in Chicago, went to Louisiana Museum of Modern Art, different versions. This was in Tokyo. And it's fractal, of course, picks up the floor, which is also fractal. And so it was a very zen-like, quiet space to meditate in one of the big rooms of the exhibition. And the other big artwork was started life at Penn. The students here built the first hedge, and it went to New York Artist Space 5 years ago. It was a big hit there, and then from there it went to Chicago, the Graham Foundation, then to the Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, and now it's stored in Los Angeles. And this has gone around the world in different versions as well. And it's essentially a study of solid and void, and it raises the question about how solid are we now thinking, because actually this whole structure, the whole artwork, is based on nothingness in the end, if you read the chapter. And it's an amazing piece that is fractal. It has no edge, no boundary. And there's a big one being built in London this summer for the big music festival in Spitalfields. And so theory, very quickly, which underpins all of this. At the Van Allen, I'm not going to talk much about this, but I just thought since you're here, I'll go quickly through it. Basically, there's a discussion on from the random, how do we get to the from the metaphor or the idea to the event. I subscribe to a process of chance that has its own instabilities in it and not predictable, but you can guide yourself to an outcome. I discuss conceptual models, the classical model of the fixed center, the deconstruction model of last 50 years, and the new model where the center is outside any boundary. So a classical distorted model, and column and beam starts to crank, columns change angle in the distortion model, but in the new model, is a cascade of feedback. So it's an emergent condition. And, you know, the fixed center, so I postulate the classical model has fixed center, it's a reductive process, and it's static essentially. And because of that, it's frozen in time, so it's timeless. Not as timeless as positive, but timeless, it has no time. The distortion model, it's a displaced center, it's ad hoc in its method. It has dynamics, and it's timely. The new emergent model, which I subscribe to, is self-organizing itself, it's inductive, the emergent, and it's timeful, opposite to that. This has its own problems. This is easier to deal with. And it's actually a manifold condition, and not a frame, and not subdivide. So these are all discussed in the book. Crossover itself is clear from intangibles to tangibles. How do you do this? It's essentially a philosophy, a process of visualization and visionary process that actually is an education. We are all born with intuition art to some extent. We get trained to reason and do our building science, architectural science, the actual product. In between is a whole educative process that goes on in schools like this, plus in your profession. That is the crossover I'm talking of, multi-zoned, multi-overlapped, multi-discipline. And I discussed time. I'll move on here. I'm running out of time, literally. It's about emotion time and body time. Time has always interested me, and in architecture, it's full of time, timely moments. I also discuss, is the world discrete, or is the world continuous, or is it an apparition? Is the discrete looking continuous? What is it? And so in the end, the whole book actually is about these two questions. Is the world irrational? And when measured, does it get beautiful? Or actually, it is irrational, and it's a sufficient condition that we are in it. It depends on how we think our brain works. So that's really the book.